Merba l-semija ta' Campus FM, Emanuel Buttigieġ li jemgawċi jil-għawkom għal-episodju ta' Taħdita Clio. Illum jiena u liem ed-deċidejna li niffukaw fuq tema li spiss missejna, pero forsi ma jidirlix li jem li d-dedikajna program eżattament dwar Malta, Turkija, l-Impero Ottoman.
Le, għat.
Dejjem nsemmu għom imma għat maffukajna. U ovvjament, almenu, zgur fiż mill-ordni, manki probabli qabel u wara, ma tistax tkellem fuq l-istorja ta' Malta minn ma titkellem fuq l-Impero Ottoman u Turkija u l-aspetti navali li joħorġu minn din ir-relazzjoni.
Sa ċertu punt il-Vant Nofsani u l-Mediterran u l-Ewropa.
Ekku. U biex nagħmlu dan għandna magħna bi pjaċir ħafna forsi l-persuna ideali biex nitkellmu dwar is-suġġett li huwa Bruno Cianci. Bruno Cianci huwa espert tal-istorja marittima tal-Mediterran, partikolarment tal-Impero Ottoman. Huwa International Press Advisor għal Rahmi M. Koç Museum ġewwa Istanbul fejn Bruno ilu jgħix mill-2008. Huwa l-awtur ta' diversi kotba u fl-2020 inħatar membru tal-Orni tal-Istilla tal-Italja għas-servizz tiegħu fit-tittib ta' relazzjonijiet bejn l-Italja u t-Turkija. Għandu laurea magister fix-xjenzi politiċi u soċjali mill-Università ta' Milan u bħalissa tieħed fuq teżi tad-dottorat tiegħu fix-xjenza u teknoloġija marittima mal-Università ta' Genova. Bruno, a warm welcome to Taħdita Clio. Liam and I are very happy to have you with us today.
Hello everybody, and thank you for inviting me to your program. It's a big honor.
It's a huge honor for us.
It's our pleasure. Bruno, I was explaining to our audience that you live in Istanbul, have been living there for a while now, and you work in this very particular museum, the Rahmi M. Koç Museum. So I wonder if you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself, your life there, and your work.
With pleasure. Well, I moved to Turkey in, it was spring 2008. At the time, I was living in Milan. I mean, I have been living and working in Milan for a few years, and I needed a change. You know, there are some moments in life when you really need a change.
Yes.
For the good, for the worse or for the better, but you need a change. And that was definitely my case. So I started to search for a suitable job. I was a professional journalist in Milan, but I don't know. I love writing. I still like writing, but I needed to do something different. And this opportunity popped up. There was a shipyard in a yacht manufacturer in Turkey who was in need of a marketing manager, and so I decided to apply, and after less than 2 months I found myself there with all my furniture, all my 25 books of boxes of books and everything. So I started a new life on the Bosphorus, on the Anatolian side of the Bosphorus, and then I stayed here. I mean, even if that job didn't work much, I decided to stay because other opportunities came afterwards. I met my present wife, and I started a family, and then also the Rahmi Koç Museum came as an opportunity, as a very interesting opportunity. I mean, I've been working there for 13 years now.
Okay.
And I assume Liam is familiar with
it. I want to jump in and say it is a beautiful museum. The first time I visited was, I think, around 2012, and the collection is something out of this world. And I must admit, I was impressed with the submarine, and I am not a modern maritime historian, but then the models, the ship models, especially the prisoner of war models in the collection are amazing. And the Ford Model T, walking around, you can see anything and everything. The collection is just beautiful and very well kept. I think the standard of the museum is just amazing. And I had the opportunity to dine there on the anniversary of the capture of Constantinople, which was quite something with all the fireworks on the Bosphorus. And I was also lucky enough to have a historic dinner over there, where we recreated what Antoine Favre was eating in Istanbul when he arrived on the Corona Ottomana. So it was quite fun, rather fun. But yes, I think I'm a little bit jealous of your job, and I don't say that a lot.
So what is the museum about? It's a technology museum?
It's, shall I?
Yes, yes,
yes, yes.
Well, it's, first of all, was established by this Turkish tycoon. Is Rami Koç. I mean, the museum is named after him. This gentleman is now 93. Very, still very active, very present. He's got a very interesting taste. He's got many mansions. They have been all stuffed with the items that are related to the history of technology, history of science, means of transport. So the museum is all about this type of item. I would call it in Museum of Industry and Transports, because
okay.
it's
okay.
Mainly the items are, I mean, belong to this category.
Uh-huh.
There are 16,500 items on display.
Wow.
On a surface which is equivalent to that of St. Peter's Square in Rome, to give you an idea. And the main venue of the Istanbul Museum, because we have two more, soon we'll have a third one, I mean,
wow.
apart from Istanbul, in Ayvalık, on the Aegean coast. It used to be a shipyard.
Yes.
I mean, the shipyard where the steamer company used to do the maintenance of their boat, their ships, in the after the 1860s.
Fascinating.
And that area was, I mean, that shipyard was actually built in the 1800s over the ruins of a previous shipyard that was used by the Ottoman Navy, because all the northern coast of the Halic, the Golden Horn, was basically fully allocated to the facilities of the shipyards of the Ottoman Empire. So it's also, historically speaking, it's an interesting area. It's quite, it used to be very run down. Now it's developing, it's gentrifying a little, also because of the presence of the Dutch Museum. That was a kind of an eye-opener also for real estate developers in the area. It's quickly changing the area. The museum is it works very well. We have, I think we had 450,000 visitors in the last 12 months. So it's we are satisfied. Nearly 1 million visitors every year, including the other Rami Koç museums across the country. Yeah.
Now, how does your relationship with Malta begin? I mean, you're a man of the sea, a bit like Liam. You sail, you write about the sea. How did Malta come into your radar?
Well, my first time in Malta was in 2003. I flew to Malta as a tourist, and I literally fell in love with the place, because I was also lucky in terms of season, because I'm a big fan of fall. I mean, autumn. And I remember those days were extremely windy, also rainy, which is the weather that I like most. You will probably wonder why I live in Istanbul when you are so fond of such weather. But I fell in love with the light of Malta. Those days were incredible. I took many, many pictures. I was focusing on fortresses. And at the time, I was working for Arte Navale. Arte Navale wanted to run an article on Malta's fortresses. I remember the text was, we commissioned the text to Timmy Gambin. You are familiar with him.
Yes.
He's a Maltese.
He's a good friend of the show.
Yes, a good friend of the show.
Send my regards if you have the chance to talk to him. And so the article came pretty well, also because I took really beautiful shots of the Sant'Angelo, of the Ricasoli, and all the, I mean,
yes.
Sant'Elmo, all the fortresses of Malta, even Fort Rinella, and I became friend to, I mean, what was his name?
Sorry. Mario Farrugia.
Mario Farrugia, yeah.
another resident of the show, yes, yes.
Yeah. I made so many friends in just a few days, and so I had the opportunity to visit again. Then I started to sail also. I mean, I was a sailor when I was a kid, but I started to do offshore races. And I did two middle sea races in a row in 2005 and 2006.
Okay.
First time with an Italian friend of mine. Next year, I was on a boat owned by the Camilleri family, and Timmy and Simon. We had a lot of fun. It was really an incredible race, and the atmosphere in Malta was very, very interesting.
Bruno, you have written a number of books, and we'd like to talk about some of them, and perhaps the one that tickles me and Liam in particular is Le Navi della Mezzaluna, which is about the navy of the Ottoman Empire from 1299 to 1923. So I imagine you try and cover the whole history of the Ottoman Navy. Talk us a bit through that.
Well, that was a crazy project because it kept me involved for, it involved me for 6.5 years, just writing, let's say, tuning the last researches and writing, because I had started the research probably in year 2000, maybe even in 1999. My father spent 2 years in Istanbul for business in the mid-90s, so I started to travel to Istanbul. I visited the Deniz Müzesi, which is the Naval Museum of Istanbul. And so I started to read about the Ottoman Navy in that period, and I studied several books, and I started to purchase all of them. And I realized that there wasn't anything comprehensive about the history of the Ottoman Navy. You could find something specific about the, about the Renegades or something about the
Barbarossa.
That was it. Aaron Bradford book about the Barbarossa brothers.
Yes.
Or you could read about the Lepanto or specific periods. There was nothing that was covering the history of the Ottoman Navy from the origins to the last period of the Ottoman Empire. And so I said maybe it could be an interesting project to work on, And I started to write it in 2008. Yeah, it was autumn 2008. Well,
And it came out in 2015, right?
Yeah, exactly. It took me six and a half years just to write it. Obviously, I was doing other things at the same time, but...
As we all do.
We have to, yeah. I'm a dreamer. I still think that it's possible to live on writing, but I mean, that's something crazy. And I was born in the wrong year.
We all were.
So I started to write it, and I liked it. I liked the idea of doing something like that. Then I found out that Daniel Panzac was also working on a similar project. And I said, oh my God, I mean, how can I publish a book on the Ottoman Navy if also someone like Daniel Panzac is working? So I thought it's going to be for sure a modest project if compared to that one. Then I found out, I got in touch with Professor Panzac, the late Professor Panzac, and I found out that he was working on he was focusing more on a later period, let's say after Lepanto to the fall of the Ottoman Empire. And actually his book was truly academic, and so it was something very different, let's say. So I felt a bit relieved after that. Professor Panzac helped me a lot. He always, we corresponded quite a lot. He always answered my emails when I had some doubts about something, and I thank him, of course, in my book. And I have very good memories of him.
Bruno, when you were working on this, were there ideas, misconceptions about the Ottoman Navy that you sought to address? I mean, I suppose one of the most wide-held ideas, which I think is a misconception, is that the Ottoman Empire was more of a land empire than a maritime empire, or that it had a heyday in the 16th century, but before and after, nothing much happened with its navy. I mean, What do you think about such ideas?
Well, it's interesting. I was fascinated by the fact that such a land empire managed to create such a powerful navy in a relatively short period of time. And they were very wise because they were making use of the right people, right personnel, Greeks, Venetians, Genoese. They were renting fleets when it was needed. They were employing Christian seamen on board, and I think, to me, it's something very fascinating, very interesting. And they really managed to create a very strong navy, maybe not as strong as that of the Venice, but that was probably because of the superiority of the Venetian weapons. Mm-hmm. So it's firearms, especially. I mean, at sea, the Venetians definitely have the better firearms. I don't know. It's something that still needs to be researched a lot, huh?
Yes.
Because there are some,
Even
also here,
going back to going into further into the 18th century, there were points that the Ottoman Navy had more ships than the Royal Navy. Even when it came to firepower, some of the capital ships and the first rates were huge. What interests me and it's a question that I really wanted to throw at you. It is the sort of constant that is the Ottoman Empire throughout the period that you are discussing. And the various factions or, let's say, challengers to the Mediterranean, to the control of the Mediterranean that came and went, but the Ottoman Empire stayed there. So you start with the competitors, with the Genoese, the Phoenicians, the Spanish, to a certain extent, then the French, then the British, all the way to the First World War. But the Ottoman Navy remained there. There will be many reasons, but is there something that you would pinpoint saying this is the reason why they remained?
Well, no, not really. I think they managed to survive until World War One because the West needed the Ottoman Empire. They didn't want to scrap it, basically, because they needed a counterbalance in the region. So I think the Ottoman Empire could have fallen much earlier than that if it wasn't for these geopolitical gains in the region. The navy was not relevant at all in the last. I mean, after
the Russian intervention, you think it was all over. After Chechnya, you think it was over.
Well, most of their fleet was destroyed. Yeah, in the late 1800s. They made a big effort during the Selim III Sultanate.
Yes,
but they never managed to handle properly the fleet, and they also lacked courage on many occasions, and that's why they were repeatedly defeated. Between the late 1800s and during the 19th century as well, and they weren't stronger enough, and they couldn't manage properly the navy. Many sultans were not even in favor of having a strong navy, apart from Abdulaziz in the 19th century. Oh. No one cared much about the Ottoman navy. After Selim III, let's say, only Abdulaziz cared about the navy, so it was also difficult every time to start from scratch.
What is the role of the Greeks in this analysis of the Ottoman Navy? What was their role?
Well, they didn't have a proper war fleet, the Greeks, in the 19th century. I mean, let's say during the War of Independence, but they were really strong. They had this merchant fleets, this armed merchant fleet that was really, I would say, provided a lot of headache to the Ottomans, and definitely contributed to the independence of Greece. After that, well, Greece became quite a, I wouldn't say naval power, but towards the end of the 19th century, they managed to purchase also some ironclads, and they became a threat to the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire couldn't basically keep the pace, and they were even defeated at sea by the Greeks before World War One during the Balkan Wars and towards the end of the 19th century. But at the time, like I said, the Ottoman Navy was already almost nothing, and was nearly nothing also during World War One. If it wasn't for those Breslau and
they visited Malta on their way to the Ottoman Empire. We we actually have the signatures of the officers, including Rudolf Hess and Dönitz signing.
Kardönitz was on the Breslau. And,
yes.
The other one, the big one, was the
Gröben. Yeah. Yes, the Gröben. They visited Malta on their way, and we actually have the German consul's guest book at the Maritime Museum, and it's quite something when you see the list of officers that were going to visit the Ottoman Empire at the time.
Bruno, we have about 4 or so minutes left, and I know that you've just published a book on quite a different subject now, Florence Nightingale. Do you want to just briefly tell us what led you there to quite a different topic?
Well, that's another topic I've been researching for years, and a lot had been written about her, so it was pretty easy to find information on her, and you know, she also spent nearly 2 years in Istanbul, in Scutari, on the Anatolian side
she came to Malta.
Of Istanbul, during the Crimean War. Well, I visited the Selinie barrack, and I started to read more and more about her, and I found out that she has written an unbelievable amount of letters that are still preserved. And so I deepened my research about her, and then I said, okay, let me write a book with a different perspective, a different angle. So I focused. I recently released this book. I mean, was published by La Terza in Italy in early 2023. I decided to focus mainly on her relation with Italy, not only because she was born there, but also because she corresponded with many, many heroes and relevant figures of the Italian Risorgimento. I really like that. And she also traveled a lot. She traveled to Egypt, she traveled to Greece, all places that I'm very
interested
fond of.
Yes.
And so I decided to write something, I would say, quite different from the literature that is covering her in the Anglosphere.
Yes, so, in the Anglosphere, yes, exactly.
And as you know, in the Anglosphere, I mean, the perspective is only there, so it's always good to see also different angles. So.
You have a beautiful list of books, and now that I see some of them, I'm quite interested in. Kemper and Nicholson. We're running short of time, but I want to ask you about Kemper and Nicholson. It is obviously your doctoral thesis. They actually own the marina at the in Birgu. And so that clicked, and I honestly didn't know that they go as far back as 1782. How's that going? You've got 1 minute to tell us.
Okay, 1 minute. My doctoral thesis covers the history of the Kemper and Nicholson's shipyard, which unfortunately is no longer active. It closed its doors in 1980, but the brand is still alive.
Yes.
There is a branch of this company that is involved in chartering super yachts and stuff like that. And the Kemper and Nicholson as a builder still exists officially as a brand. The brand is owned by Leonardo Ferragamo, who is the son of Salvatore Ferragamo, the fashion designer, and who is a King Sailor, also owns the Nautor, another Finnish yacht builder, very, very famous. And it's a University of Genoa was very much interested in this topic, so we found an agreement, and I started to search basically the archives.
The archives about
all over
okay.
Italy and England about Kemper and Nicholson. So I'm very happy to work on this subject. Yeah.
I think it's an interview for another time. It sounds very, very, very interesting.
Very much.
Bruno, we are coming to an end of our interview. It was a really, really interesting interview, which I'm sure our listeners will be very, very, very keen to listen and to re-listen, as you know, dear listeners, online at Campus FM. Bruno Cianci, thank you for being with us. On behalf of Emmanuel Buttigieg, my name is Liam Gauci. Thank you for being with us today, and we'll see you next week.